I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more powerful books of the year, such a necessary read, is Shooting Ghosts, a U.S. Marine, a combat photographer, and their journey back from war. It's a joint memoir by a Marine and a photojournalist who forged a unique friendship in Afghanistan, what sort of war it was like for them, and what it was like for them to come home. There's a moving detail about Sergeant T.J. Brennan's injury during a Taliban ambush. The book also does a marvelous job at showing how post-traumatic stress disorder affects so many, not to mention the people around them, and how a lot of people overlook it because they're not wounded on the outside. This is such a powerful book. Joining me now is Finbar O'Reilly. He is an internationally acclaimed photographer who has spent more than a decade in Africa and the Middle East. His work has won the World Press Photo of the Year Prize, the highest honor in news photography. He has held fellowships at Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and the McDowell Colony. This book is published by Viking. Please welcome to the Plant Online program from here in Vancouver earlier this week, Finbar O'Reilly. Mr. O'Reilly, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you, we were just chatting before we started about you growing up here in Vancouver. You were born elsewhere, though, right?
Yeah, I was born in the UK and then grew up for the first 9 years in Ireland. But we moved here when I was about 8, 9 years old. Initially, yeah.
Yeah, so is it still home for you?
Well, I haven't been back really for about 10 years. I've been living overseas. I was based in Africa and the Middle East for the last 15 years. And this is really a great trip back. I've been able to reconnect with old high school friends who I've been in touch with and who I've seen over the years.
Yeah.
But to come home, especially during this week where we've had some pretty spectacular weather, has been great.
Yeah, you miss the rain and so that's always a plus if you live in this town.
Exactly.
Yeah. Where did you go to high school?
I went for grades 8 till 10. I went to Kitsilano High, and then for 11 and 12, I was at Vancouver College.
I see. Yeah. I want to start with your work as a photographer because I guess because we all have phones now and that can take pictures. We think we can be a photographer like everybody else. And unfortunately, people in the journalism business, the proprietors especially, think that everybody can be a photographer. As someone who does that for a living, have you found that your work has changed over the last 10 years, say?
Well, I suppose in many ways the digital revolution and the internet has brought a huge shift to the way we, the world of photography, the way we consume photographs, but the way we consume media and information generally. So yeah, I don't think I would have even got into photography if it hadn't been for digital cameras. I was actually working as a correspondent, first of all, first in Canada for the National Post and the Globe and Mail, but then overseas for Reuters. And I was a reporter. I would write stories, and they gave me a digital camera and said, take some snaps while you're working. And that's what I did, and I found I had a bit of a knack for it and ended up taking that direction as a way of telling stories from the places where I was working in Central Africa and Congo and Sudan and places like that. But just because you have a camera, we all have cameras now on our mobile phones, that doesn't necessarily make us a professional photographer. We can all snap pictures, but really for professional photographers, you have a skill set, you have a code of ethics that you adhere to, and generally, more than anything, you have a vision of what it is you're trying to say and what it is you're trying to do. And I think that's what separates the professional photographers from what we would call user-generated content.
Yeah, you get that feeling of just how important your work is and the sort of skills that one needs to be in your line of work in this book, Shooting Ghosts, because you do have to photograph a lot of pain and suffering, sometimes. And so I'm wondering, what's that feeling like when you see someone suffering? And you're not really able to do anything.
Well, that is one of the biggest kind of ethical and moral conundrums for many photographers, myself included. When we want to be doing something through our work, we want to be bringing something that improves the situation of those we photograph, when in fact we know many times that may not be the case. It may not change the situation for the individuals we're photographing, but we do hope that through the steady flow of information, that some change, however gradual, might eventually come about, and whether that's covering a situation such as the flow of migrants from North Africa into Europe, or from Syria into Europe, highlighting the things that are problematic and trying to provide the kind of information that then lets decision makers, whether they're politicians or aid agencies that are doing the responses, allows them to make informed decisions. So it can be very difficult and heartbreaking at the time to be seeing these scenes of suffering and distress for the people you're photographing, but you do hope that in some way, ultimately, it might contribute something for the better.
And so how much of the anguish that you documented, how much of that do you take home with you when you leave, say, the war zone, for example?
Well, this is the thing. As a photographer, you do have that option to leave, and the people who you're photographing don't. They're in the situation that they're in. And so there is sometimes a sense of guilt or a sense of privilege that we, the photographers, we, the journalists, can swoop in and swoop out of these places. And, yeah, it does stay with you. It does have this impact on your kind of world view. It can shape it in ways that make you feel sometimes emotionally numb and a little bit disconnected from the world around you when you return home. And that was certainly the case for me, and I had to find ways to not become cynical or jaded, and to reconnect in ways that were more positive than negative.
There's a moment in the book where you decide that being in a war zone, as you once were, is not something for you anymore. I mean, I guess what happens in one's life, one's mind, that they decide that after chasing so much, that it's not something that they want to do anymore.
Yeah, this is something that came about after I'd been covering conflict for more than a decade, really, and I'd been exposing myself to the kinds of risks and the kind of emotional ups and downs that are involved in that kind of work. And I had seen friends getting seriously injured, losing legs in places like Afghanistan due to roadside bombs, and that's a place where I worked a lot as well. And then in Libya, while I was there covering the fall of Gaddafi in 2011, a few more friends of mine were killed there. And so you start to reassess what you're doing, the risks involved, because you start to see the impact that it has on those who you care about and who care about you. And in 2014, I was covering the summer war in Gaza between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and I just reached a point where the scale of the violence was extreme. There were bombardments and civilians, women, children being killed on a massive scale, and I was photographing these scenes in the rubble of the buildings in Gaza that had been blown up, in the morgues and in the cemeteries with the grieving family members of those who had been killed. And I reached a point where I was looking around and I was seeing the other photographers working, and I was looking at the images that I was producing, and they looked very similar to everybody else's. They looked very similar to the images of previous wars in Gaza, and I didn't feel like I was adding anything to the conversation. And in fact, I felt like in some ways, instead of condemning the scenes that I was photographing, I felt in some way complicit, as if I was contributing to this rolling depiction of war with all the sides having, you know, all the sides involved in the conflict having an interest in showing what the other side was doing, and all these lobby groups on both sides using imagery to try and tell their side of the story, and I became very uncomfortable with that.
This book is co-written with Thomas J. Brennan, TJ. Do you remember the first time you met him?
I do indeed, yes. It was at a very remote outpost, a combat outpost in the desert in southern Afghanistan, in Helmand province. And it was on the top of a little hill with a view of the surrounding mountains and desert and dry riverbed and some mud villages. And I had decided to base myself there because it was about the size of a basketball court, very remote and rugged. It looked like a scene from an old Western film. Quite dramatic landscape, and I thought maybe this small setting where there's a small group of guys might be the kind of place where I could get some intimate pictures of the U.S. Marines who were operating there, because what I discovered from my previous trips and embedded assignments with the military in different parts of Afghanistan is that the smaller the group of soldiers or Marines that you're with, mm-hmm. the better the chance that you'll get to know them, and they may come to trust you after a while. And so his squad of 15 Marines rolled in one evening and threw all their gear down in this area, the sleeping area outside. There's no cover. It was just, you know, putting up little bunks and sleeping out under the stars, exposed to the dust and the wind. And he kind of asked me, you know, who I was, what I was doing there, and I explained I was a journalist, a photographer from Reuters at mm-hmm. the time. And he wasn't super thrilled to have a journalist there. He was stressed enough with being in charge of these 15 guys in a very hostile environment where the Taliban would ambush them every time they stepped more than about 500 meters off this little base. And he was just getting to know the area, becoming familiar with it, and having a journalist around can be a liability. These guys have trained together, they fought together, they trust one another, and suddenly I'm introduced as an unknown into the mix.
And so, I mean, it does take a while for you guys, well, for him to trust you, I guess, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah, I do have to earn his trust and the trust of the other 14 Marines he was in charge of. And, you know, the day after we met, he was sent out on a foot patrol, and I was assigned to go with him, and he wasn't thrilled that I was coming out. You know, he hadn't gone out into this area before, but he knew it was very hostile. And what happened is we were walking down this alleyway about 100 meters long, so about the length of a football field, and very narrow, about the width of a one-lane street with high mud walls on both sides. And then a Taliban machine gunner opened fire from the opposite end of this, almost like a tunnel. Mm-hmm. And we ended up pinned down against the side of the wall, just hiding in the curve of the wall, just out of the range of the bullets. Not out of the range, but out of the direct line of fire. And so we got stuck there for about 15 minutes as he called in snipers to try and take out the machine gunner. And by ending up under fire together, it forged this initial bond. He knew that I was able to continue my work in that situation, take the photographs I needed, but without getting in the way of him and his men doing the job that they had to do.
Now, just considering the Afghanistan conflict for a moment, because there have been reporters, there have been photographers who have been embedded with various units throughout this war, this lengthy war. Have there been injuries sustained by the journalists, eh?
Oh, yeah. There have been a number of journalists who have been killed, others who have, like I mentioned, friends of mine who have lost limbs to improvised explosive devices along the way, and others who have been shot. And, yes, so there are some fatalities. There are some injuries, some serious injuries,
And that's something that we ought not to overlook, especially those of us who you know, are at home, who read the news or who think about these things on a regular basis. So, I mean, we think about the troops, obviously, but we need to think about folks who are there to document this stuff, right?
Sure. I mean, in my case, though, I, myself and other journalists, we make the decision to go there. This is something that we have sought out, so we would never necessarily want people to sort of feel pity for us if we do get injured or if something does happen. You know, it's very different from the situation of civilians who have war thrust upon them, not something that they wanted or sought out. But the difference is people who go to war voluntarily, journalists and soldiers and Marines, it's a little bit different. We kind of make that decision for ourselves.
And the training that you, I mean, you obviously don't train as the Marines do, but, I mean, there is a certain level of training, say, fitness that one has to do, even if you're embedded with them, right?
Well, yeah, you wouldn't be going out on 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hour foot patrols weighed down with body armor and cameras and water and food if you weren't able to physically carry all those things and be able to, you know, march for that length of time in extreme heat, because then you would become a liability to these guys and you put them at risk. So you wouldn't, you know, it's physical training as well as also just the experience of having worked in conflict zones for a number of years. You need to be able to understand and move in ways that will keep you as safe as possible.
And generally, these patrols can be pretty mundane, and I mean, that's the wrong word, but I mean, there's a lot of monotony. At the same time, there's this feeling of tension, this intense tension, foreboding especially.
Oh, yeah, they can be super boring. Yeah. It's just like a really long walk, you're tired, your gear is heavy, your helmet on your head is heavy, and you're just kind of trudging along through these desert landscapes, through mud villages that are mostly empty, and it can get very tedious and boring, because everything is quiet until suddenly it isn't. You know, there's an explosion or somebody opens fire. But a lot of the time, yeah, you could be out for hours and hours and absolutely nothing happens. And so what I would do is I would try to find things to photograph along the way. So, on one assignment, I just photographed all the colorful wooden doors of these compounds that we were kept going past. And I'd find little things to keep my mind occupied and off the potential threats.
Yeah, you read in this book, both you and TJ write about just how intense this all is, and I mean it's a particular skill set or a different sort of person that needs to do this line of work to be a Marine as TJ was.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these guys go out with a sense of duty, with a sense that they want to do something for their country, but also certainly in the U.S. there's also a kind of catchment demographic sometimes of people who may not have a lot of other opportunities. Mm. They come from low-income backgrounds or places where they decide to enroll in the military, enlist in the military, because they know that it will provide for them and for their families and maybe cover their educational costs. So there are a number of reasons why people may join the military, and some of them are keen on going to deploy and to being in combat, but I'd say a lot of them go for other reasons.
And so this bond that you and TJ have today, because I've read about the two of you in this book and I've seen interviews that you've done, I mean, you talk about how the bond is formed a moment ago. I guess for people listening to us, I mean, that's unbreakable, isn't it?
On some level, yes. You know, being in combat with somebody, you know, this is how Marines and soldiers form those bonds. You know, we talk about the band of brothers. When people have been through those things together, then they've shared something that's almost like a secret, and it's an inner circle of people. But what often happens when the military comes back from deployments is they'll scatter to the different parts of the country that they come from. They may not see each other again. But for TJ and I, not only did we share this sort of this bonding experience of combat, but we our bunks were side by side in this desert. We would talk late into the night and listen to each other's stories. And then when we came back from Afghanistan, we kept in touch, and we wrote to each other, and he told me how he was struggling with this traumatic brain injury from an ambush where he got knocked out by an explosion, and his post-traumatic stress that he was suffering, not only from almost having been killed on that particular ambush, but from things that he saw and did in Iraq in 2004 when he was there during the Battle of Fallujah. He had to kill in combat for the first time at the age of 19, and various other things that he did in combat that meant that he suffered a lot of anguish and a lot of kind of moral wounds that you might call wounds of the conscience, wounds of the soul. And so he started to write, and I helped him to kind of get in touch with editors at the New York Times, and he wrote this year-long series of stories for the New York Times about his struggles and about the difficulties he was having. And through writing, we really became even closer after coming back from the wars than we did while we were at war.
And so the process of writing between the two of you, not just this book, obviously, how did he do it, especially since he was suffering as he was?
He was very brave. He just confronted it head on, and he dealt and he grappled with the mental health issues that he was struggling with, and he just made a decision at a certain point that this is something he wanted to speak openly about, because trauma is very isolating. It makes you want to withdraw. It makes you want to hide from the world, and he felt very alone. He felt very lonely, and so much so that at one point he did attempt suicide through an overdose of drugs, but he survived that, and he decided that he never wanted to feel that low, and he didn't want others to feel that way again. So through sharing his stories, he allows others into his world and into his experiences and into his process of recovery and reconnecting with his wife and with his daughter. And the idea behind him writing those stories and us writing the book together is so that others who may be grappling with this, whether they're journalists, whether they're members of the military, or just everyday people in their civilian lives, we all encounter trauma, we all encounter difficulties at some point in our lives, whether it's lost loved ones or car accidents or crime. And so it was about trying to share this common human experience that most of us go through in our lives, and to look at what happens to people in these situations and how we can recover from these setbacks. And ultimately, it can mean therapy, it can mean medication, it can mean any of these things, but more than anything, it means a sense of community and belonging and friendship. And without those things, it's very difficult to get past the traumas of our lives.
Yeah, and you mentioned he's very brave to undertake writing about it, that which he suffers from, obviously. You read in Shooting Ghosts just how difficult it is for him to get to that point, to ask for help even.
Certainly. I mean, both of us, he in the military and me in the media, you know, war journalists or journalists who cover conflict, it's a pretty macho thing. You know, we've got to all be tough, we've got to be strong, and the idea of showing any kind of perceived weakness is frowned upon. And certainly in the military, they don't want to encourage people to say there's something wrong with me. They need people to be able to function. They need people to be able to fight and deploy. So anybody who is unable to do that is considered often damaged goods and not helpful. So they don't want to encourage people to discuss these things openly. It's kind of glossed over, and this is something that has existed for a long time, for many mm-hmm. generations.
And I mean, to think that someone will read this and be helped by his writing. I mean, does TJ think about that at all?
That's his main motivation, I think. Not only grappling and understanding his own experiences, but being able to share them with others in a way that might be helpful. And that's certainly been the case. He's been contacted by people who had, you know, members of the military who had been contemplating suicide themselves, and they read his work, they read his stories, and they listened to what he had to say. And they got in touch with him saying, well, you know, I was thinking this, but then after I read what you wrote, it made a lot of sense. And I understood that I'm not alone in this struggle. And that is the most powerful thing for him, to be able to have that kind of impact on somebody.
Well, what's it like for TJ now who does suffer still? Does writing about it, reliving it as he does and talking to people about it, does it relieve any of his own trauma?
Oh, yeah, I think it certainly does, but up to a point. I think the thing that he's had to do once he left the military and this sort of brotherhood of the U.S. Marine Corps is that he had to find a new mission and a new sense of purpose in the civilian world, and he did that through becoming a journalist himself. He did online degrees in journalism. He got into Columbia University, which is the best journalism school in the world, in New York. And he's since started his own digital newsroom covering the military in the mm-hmm. U.S., and it's been wildly successful. It's broken some huge stories, some big scandals in the military, and so he has this new mission, this new purpose and role, and also community. Still connected with the Marines, but he's also got this community of journalists and people who support him and give him this sense of meaning and purpose in his life.
So I saw both you and TJ on the PBS NewsHour recently, and the interviewer that you both spoke with said that you know, if you look at TJ, he looks fine,
right.
and he gets that a lot, I guess, from people, and so it's marvelously instructive in this book as to how we need to do better in terms of reacting to people that are wounded, especially those whose wounds we can't see.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing he struggles with. So many people, you know, soldiers and Marines who go to war, say if they lose a leg or have a serious injury, physical injury, we can see that. We know what's happened. But mm-hmm. but his injury is also a physical one. It's a lump of his brain that is damaged. But when we look at him, it's hidden. It's within his skull. We don't know what it is. But you know, I know that he has difficulty remembering things. I know he has to write them down to recall what he has to do each day. He gets anxious and he struggles in many ways. He gets severe migraine headaches mm-hmm. And is short-tempered sometimes. So these are all things that affect his daily life, his family life. And when we look at him, when we listen to him, we don't necessarily see those kinds of things.
Yeah. In this book, do you or TJ contend with the necessity of the war in Afghanistan at all?
Well, no. We didn't want to do a sort of political commentary necessary or a polemic. It was more just about this is what the experience of war looks, feels, sounds, and smells like, and this is the impact that it can have on individuals. The idea of whether it's right or wrong or how the war has been being run politically or economically, those are not questions we grapple with too heavily. It's something that we leave for the pundits, we leave for the people who want to debate on TV over mm-hmm. these things. We're just looking at it from a very, you know, boots on the ground, here we are, this is what we see.
And at that, it's a very powerful book and a memorable one, and an important one that people ought to read. So congratulations to both you and TJ on it, and I hope it does well in terms of people picking it up and reading it, because it's something that... even though we think about the war in Afghanistan a lot, I don't think we think about it enough. And this is a marvelous way, this book is, to reorient ourselves with that part of the world, especially, and the people that have come home from it.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you, indeed.
Thanks for your time today, Finbar.
My pleasure, Joe. You take care.
The book is called Shooting Ghosts, a U.S. Marine, a Combat Photographer, and Their Journey Back from War. It's published by Viking. Finbar O'Reilly, one of its authors, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.